From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Food, for me, it's like the mob is to Scorsese. It is a bottomless pit of ideas and connective tissue between people.
That's Alton Brown. If you look at his career trajectory, you see how his considerable peripatetic brain has pushed him to take on many personas. The super nerdy yet entertaining TV cooking science guru of Good Eats. The slick, uber-knowledgeable host commentator of Iron Chef America. The grizzled, motorcycle-riding eater on the road from Feasting on Asphalt. The sadistic puppet master of Cutthroat Kitchen. Now Brown is the host of a live culinary variety show, Eat Your Science, which is coming to the Pantages here in L.A. in March. I made you laugh.
You did.
That's always a good thing.
The fact that you used peripatetic was wonderful, but the sadistic puppet master, oh my God, that's so beautiful. Can I use that?
Absolutely.
Currently, my business card says highly functioning sociopath on it, but I think I'm gonna switch it over to sadistic puppet master.
Glad I could provide you with fodder.
Oh my gosh, it's so wonderful.
So I have to ask you,
every time
you switch up your persona and delve into a new obsession, Are the previous show's fans devastated?
The only time that has happened that I can recall was when I started making Cutthroat Kitchen, because a lot of people that are in my line of work are 100% themselves all the time on camera. It's like setting the EQ on your personality. You know, you dial in certain portions of it, you dial back things. And so every time that I'm on TV, I kind of look at what's needed of a character and I dial myself into it. So it's like if you really want to know me, Good Eats is probably as close as you'll get. But then also, that was scripted. So that's a very planned side of me. The Iron Chef America side was more me as sportcaster. And then the Cutthroat Kitchen is me with about, you know, four drops of Hannibal Lecter added. So there were people that were furious with me as being, you used to be such a nice guy. Now you're just bad. And it's like, and there was this meme on the internet of, there was a picture of me from Good Eats days looking in, you know, from an oven cam shot and then me on Cutthroat. And it said, you know, you either die a hero or live to be the villain, you know, so they really saw it as this huge shift in my personality. Well, it's not. It's a role that I'm playing on television. It's just me as a slightly darker, you know, kind of Shakespearean Iago version of myself, I guess.
And also the people who kind of not got stuck on the Good Eats, but the people who really were big Good Eats fans, as you slimmed down and got more styly.
And, I did. And you know, and the style is funny. I got styly because I got thin.
Yes, of course.
You know, what's funny is, you know, the second you get thin, when you've been heavy all your life, you're like, hell yeah, I'll wear the plaid double-breasted blazer. When in reality, that's not you, you know? And it's like, and it's funny because I've had to deal with the fact that I got thin and thought that I was going to be happy with what I looked like when I was thin. In reality, I wasn't. It was like, oh my God, I wanted to be thin all my life. Now I am, and I don't. It doesn't really suit me.
So this show that you're doing, it's your second. The first was the Edible Inevitable tour.
Edible Inevitable.
Given your original background as a youth, your theater arts background, this must be just the best for you because you get to bring all those personas kind of together in the stage show. Or is that yet another one?
What it did, moving on to a stage show, was I like to dare myself. Can I do this? Can I pull this off? Do I have a skill set? Can I develop a skill set that will allow me to do this? And I had always really loved doing live stage things, but you know, usually they're one-offs. They're food festivals, or you're doing some big corporate gig that you're a hired gun for. But I realized that I really want to do something larger. But to answer your question, I don't know that it was kind of coming full circle. Theater's always been there. It wasn't me trying to finally be able to call up my mom. By the way, I did this. We were on Broadway for a week in November with this show, and I was finally able to call up my mom and said, see, the theater degree finally paid off. And then she said, can I get seats? And I said, no, we're out, and hung up the phone. Part of it was maybe trying to make sense of life and make life be full circle. But ultimately, I'm just always trying to figure out where food can go that somebody hasn't taken it. Can I do a live stage show? Can I do a big variety show about food and entertain people? And I had to know. I had to find out. And the answer is yes. And in this day and age, when we are so torn apart by so many parts of life. The internet has made it possible for each one of us to live in our own little private bubbles. We have very little connective tissue to each other anymore. Food provides that. And I think one of the reasons that food remains this just fertile area of social growth is because we all need it and we all love it. No one says, I don't like food.
So much has changed in the food world, the restaurant world. I mean, the influence of TV, of you and all of your confreres on the Food Network, has been such a huge influence in the culinary world and in how consumers, how diners see the culinary world. Is there anything that you've seen pop up over the last, let's say, 5 years that makes you nuts, that you wish would go away?
As I look at the landscape, the culinary landscape, both for home cooks and the marketing of food in the grocery store, restaurants, if I'm annoyed by anything, it is the requirement by fans, not customers. Notice I'm not using the word customers, but fans, to constantly evolve and do something new. And the reason that that really bothers me is that there are chefs who just do certain things very, very well. And now they're compelled to constantly change their menus to provide new thrills and new Instagram opportunities. And I hate that. My favorite restaurants, I don't want their menus to change very often. You know, I want to go. I want to have the same martini that I have. I want to have the same steak that I have, or whatever it is. And it's real difficult in the shifting sands of the restaurant world to find that. And I think that the same can be said of home cooking. You know, it used to be that home cooks would perfect 10 dishes.
Everybody had 10 dishes in their rotation.
You know, or, you know, Miss Smith down the street made this lemon chiffon cake, and everybody, she owned that cake. And I love the identities that came out of that. It didn't mean that you just made that same 10 things all the time, but they were yours. And now people are kind of just floating. They're trying to try so many different things. And, oh, my God, I've got to cook with sumac now. Oh, my sheesh, what am I going to do with this harissa? Oh, my gosh, Korean. I've got to now learn Korean. Slow down. It's like we can all still have a culinary identity. So as we have this onslaught in the media, certainly, of constantly, and food media, constantly finding new, constantly discovering something that hasn't been discovered, that we lose what food for home cooks really ought to be and what the real magic of food is, which ultimately is its ability to connect human beings. I'm almost at my wit's end with people taking pictures of food for Instagram. To experience food primarily through a small photograph rather than sitting down and enjoying the person in front of you is potentially extremely harmful. When restaurants start hiring lighting consulting firms so that they can have better light for Instagram photos, I wonder if we're not really off track. I could be wrong, because there are a lot of great restaurants, a lot of great cooks, a lot of great ingredients, a lot of great stores, a lot of great markets getting fantastic exposure from the internet, from Instagram, from these kind of visual cues. But ultimately, I don't know where that will go and whether it's going to be, you know, will eventually cooking become a game like Guitar Hero where it's all virtual and we're not really doing it anymore? I don't know. But I think a lot about it and I worry about it. And I know that I'm one of the people that set it all in motion.
You know, it's interesting because when I think back to the early 2000s, mm-hmm. and maybe even the 90s, and I think about how people used cookbooks then and culinary magazines, cooking magazines, I think for a lot of people, it was pure porn. I think more people are cooking now again.
I agree.
Which is
that is one of the good effects of all
it
of this.
Is one of the good effects. And it's kind of fascinating to me to watch what people really love to do. And I think what you said about sort of simplicity versus crazy complexity is I hope that there's going to be a swing. For you yourself, in this crazy brain in which you live, what do you cook that grounds you? Like, if you're just on your own, you're mm-hmm. home, you're hungry, what is it that
you cook? Very simply, to be honest with you. And my cooking has changed. I got divorced a couple of years ago. I live alone now. And so that has forced me to kind of really think about, because I'm often cooking for just myself, and I travel a lot, and I cook when I'm on the road. So I've pared everything way down. And so I'm still at the point now of like, okay, I'm going to make a plate of scrambled eggs. What what am I really doing here? I've gotten down to this incredible minutia, almost zen-like minutia of certain foods, of I'm going to roast a chicken. That's all I'm going to do. I'm going to roast a chicken. I'm not roasting a chicken with farro and free-range shiitakes with – no, I'm going to just roast a frickin' chicken. Or you know what? I'm going to make a salad. How few things do I need to make a salad? And how is this vinaigrette really going to illuminate this ingredient or this ingredient? So I'm collapsing culinarily back into kind of some dense core center of skills that is forcing me to reevaluate how I identify with food, which is why – you know, the last book that I did was a book strictly of my own recipes of food that I cook, which forced – it's almost like a self-portrait. You know, I reached the point where I needed to have some kind of benchmark of, okay, who am I as a cook? Because I didn't know anymore. Everyday Cook came out last year and scared the hell out of me because it's me. It's self-portrait. It's self-portrait in food.
So when you say it scared you, why did it scare you?
Because all the recipes that I have ever written have been – for presentation to the outside world. Out of, you know, all the recipes that I wrote for Good Eats, those were written for a TV show. And when you're doing that or you're writing them for a book and in my other books, you're writing them from scratch and you're carefully constructing them. Writing a cookbook of your own recipes is kind of like being forced to renovate your own home while you're living in it. And what it does is it leads to mistakes. It leads to questioning things because, you know, when you cook for yourself, a lot of these recipes were literally scribbled in pencil on the inside of cupboard doors.
Oh, that's really smart.
Because
way
I
to
do
it.
That. No, I don't know if it's smart. If you were to just come into my like apartment and open doors, you'd think I was like Kevin Spacey's character in Seven. You know, it's like this funny little scribble all over the place. But it's super easy to make mistakes because you've written your notes for you, the cook you are, not the cook everybody else is, which is what I had always done before. So I second guess everything. So, I mean, I'm looking at, okay, this is how I make my pasta. Well, why am I doing that? Because everything I've ever done has been based on make sense. That was my absolute mantra and my rule in working in recipe development. Everything must make sense. Every ingredient is there for a reason. Every process is there for a reason that can be explained. But when you're cooking for yourself, some things just develop because it is actual, I'm not even going to say artistry. It's there's something about the self-expression of cooking food for yourself that can defy those rules. But now I've got to adapt that for a book. And it's terrifying because you're also like, now if people don't like them, it really does matter. Because they don't like them, they don't like me.
That is scary.
So that's like having people truly into your home and I'm going to make you chili. And if you don't like the chili, what does that say? What does that say about our relationship? Can you overlook that? I don't know. So it was a very frightening thing for me. And as people started to like post photographs on Twitter and Facebook of my recipes done by them, I was mortified. I didn't know how to respond to it. I still don't. It's still scary to me.
So since we've had this kind of small moment of therapy, I understand that your new stage show that you're bringing to the Pantages will have moments of therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. you've been reading the interwebs. I might do that during a certain scene where I do a long rant called If I Were a Food God, about the things that I would do in the world if I was actually the overarching god of food. And one of them potentially involves a tough love therapy session with a member of the audience. It's all in good fun, but I don't want to give anything more away than that.
I hope you get someone thick-skinned.
I'm not abusive, but I will sometimes ride right up on the edge of abuse. Everybody thinks it's hilarious, usually
sure.
Even the person that it's happening to. But generally people – everything that I do in the shows that involves audience interaction, and I do a lot of it, is all based on volunteers. So if somebody raises their hand, they want to play. It's an invitation to play, and play we do. Play we do. And sometimes it is the laughs are had at the volunteer's expense, but more likely they're at my expense, as it should be.
You did Good Eats for 14 years.
14 solid years.
And I noticed that repeat shows are airing now. So does that mean that we're about to be gifted with a sequel?
Well, what the interesting twist of the media world, you know, the show is popular. I made 252 episodes, and then I was kind of tired. And it was becoming a very expensive show because I was such a perfectionist and continue to be. But what happened is that the show never went off the air on Cooking Channel, which is the smaller, slightly runt sister of the runt sibling of Food Network. But the real break came when Food Network decided to start giving Netflix sets of Good Eats shows. And then Good Eats found a whole new audience of people that thought I was actually making that for Netflix. They didn't know that the show had existed before. And they were like, well, is this an old show? I'm like, look at me. Look how much hair I have. I was a baby. I mean, I was 34 when I started making that show. But then I, you know, people were like, we want more of this. Please, we want more of this. And so that's when I realized it's been long enough. I've had a break, and it's time for me to get back to the thing that I probably do best, which is a Good Eats-like program. But when I started that show, and even when I finished it, the internet, digital, it was very much still fledgling. There weren't many outlets. Social media didn't exist. So I realized that if I was going to do this again, it would need to be for digital. It would need to be for online delivery, not for a television network. So that it won't be called Good Eats because Food Network owns that title, and it won't be on Food Network. It'll be online. And I'll do it on my website for – I'm going to give it about a year on my website to see how it goes. And then we'll see if we spread out to a wider distribution. Netflix. Sorry. I clear my throat. We'll see. We'll see. But the nice thing is that people are screaming for it. And during the live show, whenever I mention Good Eats, people cheer. So it's the thing to do. It's time. It's time to come home.
Yes, it is time. So I can't let you go without this portion.
Sure.
As a former film major in college and a native Angelina, I have to ask you mm-hmm. about your connection to the movies. Several years ago, you were a guest programmer on Turner Classic Movies.
I was.
Do you remember the movies that you...
I remember I chose 1966. I decided to go with the year.
I did.
I chose 1966 because as I was looking through their catalog, which you have to do, and I was looking, I decided to build a juxtaposition. So if I remember correctly, I chose a very obscure Czechoslovakian New Wave film called Closely Watched Trains, which was a political, political film that was really about the Soviet occupation. I went to the opposite side of the wheel and chose the very, very wacky mashup Woody Allen film called What's Up, Tiger Lily, which, of course, was a film that was just dubbed
hilarious.
Onto pieces of other film that was already done. My favorite Lee Marvin film, Point Blank, with Carol O'Connor, a great, great crime movie. And then... I can't remember there was one more.
Blow Up.
I did Blow Up. I did Antonioni's Blow Up. How could I forget that? With David Hemmings as the photographer and a very young Vanessa Redgrave. And it was great because TMC was completely supportive. They were like, most of these films, nobody's seen any of these films. So they were completely game with it. Of course, they haven't asked me back, but
I think it's time.
But it was such a thrill. It was a thrill.
I think it's time they ask you back.
As somebody that spent most of my life, when people ask me, well, what are you? I say, I'm a filmmaker. It's just I've spent most of my life making films about food. It's my story thing, but I am a filmmaker. So whenever I get to talk about that or whenever I get to be involved in that, it's a big thrill because nothing has been more influential in my life than cinema.
Have you ever acted seriously in a film?
No. I was offered a recurring role on a TV show called Breaking Bad.
You would have been so good.
It was pointed out to me by others around me that it was going to be very difficult to cook food on Food Network and meth on another. So I declined the fantastic job on Breaking Bad. I would love to be in a movie. I would love to finally get back to directing and direct a movie. And I've got several ideas for feature documentaries, food-centric, and as well as a very black comedy about Thanksgiving. Because there are no great Thanksgiving movies. You ever notice that? We have great Christmas movies, but there are no great Thanksgiving
movies.
There's not really.
I guess that's true. That's true. I always think of Christmas Story, but that is Christmas, not Thanksgiving.
It's in the title.
Yes, it is.
It's a dead giveaway.
But there's the turkey.
There's the turkey and the Bumpus dogs and the final journey to the Chinese restaurant, which it's a great movie. But I would love to spend more time behind the camera.
I just want to see you in a role where this sadistic puppet master really gets to stretch.
I'm not actually naturally mean. It's hard. The first time that I had to kick somebody off a TV show, by the way, was I did 5 seasons of kind of a miniseries show called Next Iron Chef on Food Network. And I had to tell chefs that were competing, I'm sorry, you will not be the Next Iron Chef. And the very first season, I mean, these were hardcore chefs. And Tracy Desjardins, a San Francisco chef, I don't even have the right – I couldn't even stage in her kitchen. And I remember having to look at her and tell her – first, she was the first one off – that you will not be the Next Iron Chef. And I did it, and she walked away. They called cut. I walked off set and puked into a trash can.
Oh, my gosh. On that note. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was very nice to talk again.
Find out where to get tickets for Alton Brown's new culinary variety show. It's called Eat Your Science. On our website, go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Up next, we hear how President Trump's immigration policies are affecting street vendors in L.A. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman.
Fernando Carrillo, Ragtop Friends Barbecue. And we are in Koreatown, Filipino town, however you want to call it. We're like kind of middle in the border.
They're not doing anything wrong. All they're doing is just trying to make an honest living and do what they can with what they can. I mean, if they're going to deport people, I mean, deport drug dealers, deport, you know, murderers and rapists and people that do worse things than trying to sell corn or fruit or tacos or tamales or whatever you can off the street, you know? Go get somebody else that's actually the bad guy, not somebody that's just trying to feed their family and survive.
His parents emigrated here from Mexico in the 70s. Each weekend, on the same Koreatown block where he was born and raised, he sells his street meat in front of his apartment building under the name Ragtop Ferns Barbecue. Selling food and merchandise on sidewalks in L.A. is technically illegal. But currently, there are 50,000 vendors doing it. Many of them are undocumented. So elected officials recently voted to decriminalize street vending. This is a subject that has passion on both sides, both pro-legalization and con selling food on the streets. But we wanted to bring to you the latest news of what's happening. We asked Rudy Espinoza to break it all down for us. He's the executive director of the community development group Leadership for Urban Renewal Network, or LURN. Just a note here, when we recorded this interview on Wednesday, the vote had not yet been passed on the decriminalization of street vending. Hi, Rudy.
Hi, Evan.
Immigrant groups have been trying to change this law for years and have a regulated system for street vending. But a lot has happened in the past couple of weeks. Could you give us a quick recap?
Yeah, sure, Evan. As you said, this struggle has been going on for decades, unfortunately, and my organization is part of a new initiative that's trying to legalize this activity again. For the last 4 or 5 years, we've been working as part of the LA Street Vendor Campaign with a bunch of organizations to create a legal permit system for sidewalk vendors. We've been working on a policy formally for 3 years within City Hall, and it's been making its way through committee. At the end of last year, we started to see some progress. After the election of the current president, there was a lot of discussion within City Hall about what they can do to support immigrants. And because of that, they moved forward and said, you know what, we need to really get to work and create a legal permit system for all these entrepreneurs that may face threats from the administration. And so there's been a great effort, a framework that has been proposed that would create a permit system for sidewalk vendors. And there's also an effort to decriminalize vending. Right now, a vendor can get a misdemeanor, can get their equipment confiscated, and could even be arrested. And so what they're working on right now is an effort to strip that. And obviously, folks would still get fines and still get citations, but they wouldn't get a misdemeanor.
So the idea, which happened in City Hall just a couple of weeks ago, is to bifurcate the process, because obviously the process of legalizing street vending involves so many different parts of the municipality's regulatory structure. You have land use issues, you have pushback from business owners, you have the taxing authorities, the health department. All that is going to take time to get work down until there's a good boilerplate that everybody can sign off on, right?
Correct. So what happened in City Council a couple of weeks ago, after the culmination of all these years of advocating and the City Council sort of getting around sort of this idea that maybe we should create something, what they did is they voted on a couple of different motions. The first one was a request to ask the city attorney to draft an ordinance that would decriminalize vending. And that's sort of what I just mentioned, which would strip the misdemeanor penalty for selling food or merchandise on the sidewalk. That's really important. So they asked the city attorney to do that. And then the second thing that they asked the city attorney is they voted to ask him to draft an ordinance that would create that permit system. That is obviously going to take a few more months, and that's going to require a lot of different departments and business owners and residents and advocates coming together to create that process. But you're right, there's two things that took place. One of them is a decriminalization effort that will happen very soon. And then the second is the development of the permit system itself.
There's still so much to work out with the full legalization of this proposal. I mean, LA has so many different neighborhoods. Neighborhoods have different characters. So some neighborhoods are probably embracing this idea, while other neighborhoods who have never experienced street food vending are probably fearful about what would happen. What are you hearing from the vendor side, particularly in terms of the 2 vendor per block measure that's in the rule?
Well, that's a really good question. The LA Street Vendor Campaign, which is our coalition of many organizations, is actually led by street vendors. And so we work with them. They organize themselves in work groups throughout the city. So they've been involved in designing the policy that we are proposing as a campaign. And they're encouraged by the progress. There is some sort of feelings of celebration, but many of them are concerned about the details. The devil's always in the details. And so over the course of the next few months, they are prepared to advocate for a good policy. And one of their concerns is one of the recommendations which was set forth by the city council, which is to limit 2 vendors per block. We're hearing from the vendors is that an arbitrary limit, such as 2 vendors per block, doesn't take into account the diversity of our city's built environment. Some blocks are really long and the sidewalks are really wide and they could accommodate more vendors, and others are really narrow and small and can't accommodate any. What they'd like to propose is a system in which the limit on vending, quote unquote, would be based on the built environment itself. There's also concerns, Evan, of another recommendation, which is to require vendors to get permission from an adjacent business owner to sell. And so they're worried that that's going to open the door for exploitation, because that already happens to a certain extent today. Today in the city, without a permit system, many businesses actually charge sidewalk vendors to be there as a form of protection, as a way to sort of promise to the vendor that, hey, I'm not going to call the cops if you pay me a few $100 a month. And so we're worried that putting that into the policy is only going to open the door for more of that.
And also this idea that a business owner can have jurisdiction over the sidewalk seems kind of odd, because the sidewalk is a public space.
Correct.
But it also seemed at the meeting that I attended that several business owners were really wedded to this idea.
Yes, and there's certainly some organized business groups are pushing this idea. To a certain extent, I understand, Evan, and so does the LA Street Vendor Campaign. We believe that we can create a policy where both small businesses and vendors both, you know, flourish. We just don't want to give one segment of entrepreneurs power over another. And there's many examples, Evan, throughout our city where vendors and small businesses are working together, because there is a good group of brick and mortar businesses that realize that mobile vendors actually attract more customers to commercial corridors. And we certainly know that there is some districts in our city that need help. They need more customer traffic. And we believe that vendors, if given an opportunity, can help attract the pedestrians and the customers that that we need.
So what happens now? Will there be more sort of open hearings in council chambers where we hear sort of more of the boilerplate? or will it all be delivered sort of whole cloth?
The next step is that the ordinance that the city attorney drafts will be sent to the committees that it's tagged to, which I believe is Economic Development and Public Works. So certainly there will be opportunities for the public to get involved and to show up to those committee meetings and provide commentary to advise the city council on how they should move forward and how they should craft this policy. So yes, there will be opportunities. We encourage folks to like the LA Street Vendor Campaign's Facebook page, because there we often give up-to-the-minute updates on what's going on, and we let people know when the committee meetings are happening. And I think that that's really super key for everybody to know, is that street vending is not legalized yet. The vote that happened recently was super important and was a great step forward, but we still have more to go. We still have to craft a policy and make sure it works for folks, because we don't want to just enact a policy that's going to, you know, be terrible.
No, not after all the years and all the hoping and all the work to finally get something going on. To have it blow up would just be awful.
Right.
But decriminalization, is it already out there?
That's going to be voted on this week. So that piece is being expedited. And again, because of the threat from the White House of deporting folks that are arrested, the city council is moving fast on that one. So that'll be soon.
Thank you so much, Rudy, for coming in and giving us an update on it.
Oh, thank you for having me, Evan.
That's Rudy Espinosa, Executive Director of Leadership for Urban Renewal Network. Postscript. After we recorded this interview, the City Council voted to decriminalize street vending 13-0. You can find out what vendors think on our blog. Go to blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Now it's time to find out where our favorite food critic is eating. Jonathan, where are we headed today?
It's, I think, the first Kurdish restaurant that I've seen in California. I mean, there's sort of a burgery restaurant that has a few Kurdish dishes on it. And a long time ago, I wrote about an Iranian restaurant that was secretly a Kurdish restaurant but had only Iranian recipes on the menu. The restaurant is Niroj. It's sort of a fancy place with tapestries on the tables and paintings on the walls and a giant wine rack.
Are we there for giant plates of rice?
There are giant plates of rice, but it's not kind of the point of the place. The thing about Kurdish cooking is the area populated by Kurds, Greater Kurdistan, is vast. It's huge. And it takes in parts of Turkey and Iran and Iraq and Syria and Armenia even. And apparently wherever the Kurds are, the cooking takes on the character of where they are rather than having one big sort of overarching cuisine.
So it's regional, almost as if it were a diaspora cuisine.
Right. So a lot of what you're going to see on the menu here is very close to what you've seen at other sort of Middle Eastern restaurants. I mean, if you get the cold meze plate, which is always a good idea, there'll be hummus, there'll be baba ganoush, there'll be something delicious that I'm pronouncing it completely wrong, but hesandine, with, you know, roasted red peppers, walnuts, pomegranate molasses.
So delicious.
So good. There's a falafel that's denser and super forest green inside, but recognizably falafel. And borek that look like egg rolls from a Chinese restaurant, but it's the dough wrapped around feta cheese and herbs.
How do you even get beyond the appetizer plate?
I'm not sure you have to. You order a cold appetizer plate and a warm appetizer plate, and you're done. And there's actually something that I think they call a signature feast that gives you mostly that, though it also gives you a lot of kebabs. Kebabs are big there. And there's some kinds of kebabs that I never quite seen before. There's a lot of brown mixture of beef and lamb. Their specialty, they call the Niroj kebab, which is rolled around a little bit of spinach, and there's a little cream and a few drops of pomegranate molasses.
I love that.
It's a really good kebab. Maybe my favorite, they call the Levant kebab, which is very similar to the Niroj kebab, except it's served on a bed of flatbread that soaks in the juices.
And then that's like dessert.
Right.
So good.
So good.
Anything else?
The food is not highly seasoned. And I'm not sure whether that's characteristic of all of Kurdish cooking or whether it's characteristic of this place. I think that if you were on like a low-salt diet, actually this place would probably be good. There's something called melegej, which they translate as dizzy clergy, which is eggplant with peppers, onions, spices.
Like imam bayaldi.
It's exactly that. And it's, again, a little bland, but it's really good. One of the things you shouldn't do here is miss dessert, because the baklava, which is made in-house, is good, but even better is the...
Kunafe?
Kunafe. You knew.
It's phyllo dough that's finely shredded.
Is it?
Yeah. So it's like shredded wheat, kind of.
It is a little like shredded wheat. I mean, I've actually bought kunafe dough to, like, make from bakeries in Hollywood, but I didn't know that it was shredded phyllo. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Ooh, teaching you something. But it's the combination of the cheesiness with the syrup.
Melted cheese with just a tiny, tiny little touch of rose.
Yum. That's Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, talking about Niraj in Agoura Hills. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations.
These young people are gambling everything on one of the riskiest businesses around. I want to watch this.
That's Karen Stabiner talking about the millennial generation of chefs who were raised on televised food competition where everyone is a food critic. Stabiner's a journalist who has a new book out called Generation Chef, Risking It All for a New American Dream. I know you've been fascinated by the stories of individuals who decide to open restaurants forever. Full disclosure, 30 years ago, you followed me and my business partner around for months as we prepared to build and open our second restaurant. So much has changed in the last 30 years. So much has changed, like the internet, food TV, et cetera, et cetera. Yet the challenges of opening a restaurant remain. What made you want to examine how this new generation gets hooked in?
Oh, let's see. I suppose the truth is I wanted an excuse to hang around a restaurant for a year and a half, but that doesn't sound very professional, does it? I had been working on a cookbook that required me to be in kitchens talking to young cooks about staff meals that they were making for their colleagues. And it didn't take long to notice that the average age was maybe 23, 24. They were all in a desperate hurry. You heard them saying things like, if I don't have a restaurant by the time I'm 30, I'll never have one. There's the 1 year and out rule, which is if I don't see a path to advancement at the end of the year, I have to look for another job or I'm going to get smothered. And I thought, as crazy as it's always been, now it's even crazier. So I figured it was going to be a great story about something that I love.
So to put it into context of in New York City, to be noticed by reviewers. I mean, just forget about getting a great review, but just your odds of being on their radar for them to go into your place. Give us a little sense of how rare that is.
I think that was one of the things that I didn't really see coming, how desperate they were going to be for that New York Times review and what a fluke it was that they got it. They opened in April. By August, Jonah had quietly stopped cashing his paycheck. And he said to me, if Pete Wells, who is the New York Times critic, if he doesn't come in after Labor Day, there's a good chance we're going to have to close. So I sort of sat down and did the math. Okay, one review a week, 52 reviews a year, and there are more than twice that number of new restaurants in New York City every year. So you're as likely not to get reviewed as you are to get reviewed. And there's essentially nothing you can do about it. I interviewed Wells after he came to Huertas. I didn't want to interrupt the process. And he said he keeps a list that restaurants can sit on for a year. And then finally they fall off the bottom because they're too old.
Wow. Let's back up a bit. Where was he working before? And how long had he been working in restaurants before he decided that he had to just go for broke and start his own place?
Jonah's first restaurant job is the stuff of myth. It's going to follow him around forever. He had a friend who got a gift certificate to Chanterelle, which was the legendary 4-star restaurant opened by David Waltuck when David was 23. And so the two boys went there in their suits and their ties, and David's wife, Karen, who ran the front room, invited them to see the kitchen. And David took them around and said, "Do you have any questions?" And the boys were completely tongue-tied. So they went home, and Jonah immediately wrote him a thank you note and said, yes, he did have a question. Could they work there for free next summer? So at 14, he was learning from David Waltuck in sort of the old European apprentice model how to prep vegetables. When he was 15, he learned how to butcher. When he was 16, he went out and got a job and then eventually tried some very high-end places, many of whom turned him down because they were sure he was lying on his resume. So he worked at Gramercy Tavern for Danny Meyer, went to college, finished up college, and his first real grown-up job was as a line cook at Maialino, which is Danny's Roman restaurant. He was probably on track to be an executive sous at some point, but he looked ahead. He didn't see the opening. He was impatient because he was already older than David Waltuck. So he quit what many other people in this city would kill for and set out to open Huertas.
You know, it's like I think to myself, I mean, obviously it worked out well for him, but this idea of just seasoning, of like staying in a job and sinking into the dailiness of it, is what gives you the DNA to be able to go out and be successful.
It's interesting that you say that because I was at a panel over the weekend where the two chefs
in a minute
panel
we traveled to what may be
and
the
they were
only
saying exactly
Kurdish
that
restaurant in the
from
Western
their
U.S.
Ancient
stay
perch,
with us.
They were saying, you know, this is not really what it means to be a chef. Now, in Jonah's case, I would say he's like a young old man. He'd been doing it for 12 years before he ever opened the restaurant. So his timestamp is a little bit different.
There's this line in the book attributed to Luke, who was the manager, correct?
He was the other partner who ended up leaving, although he maintained his partner's equity.
There's this moment where he's saying that the media is always thinking of the next big thing. So you find yourself in the day to be racing, not pacing.
Mm-hmm. He's a very wise guy, Luke, and I think he provided a good balance when they were starting out. The problem is you can't respond to that by saying, it's true, I'm going to slow down and start pacing because everybody will run right over you. It's a very, very hard time, and I know you see this in Los Angeles as well because our number of full-service restaurants is actually shrinking. Your number of full-service sit-down restaurants is growing. So you're kind of where New York was a couple of years ago, for better or worse. It becomes this frenzy. How can you possibly take another year or two to season yourself when all of your friends are opening restaurants? And I think that's the dilemma that this generation faces. I mean, when Jonah was a teenager, 12 years ago, there was no social media and no competition television. And we forget that it's all that recent. But if that's how things go these days, you don't really have the luxury of slowing down unless you decide to opt out. And part of what I hope makes Generation Chef sort of a fuller story is that there are other chefs as sort of supporting characters who took different ways out. And one of them was Gavin Kaysen, who had worked for Danielle Boulud forever, was in his early 30s, everyone was sort of waiting to see what Gavin was going to do. And he said he woke up one morning, he was walking the dog, looking around, and he thought, I don't have to be in New York. I don't have to participate in this rat race. And he went home to Minneapolis with his wife and his two kids, and he opened a stunningly beautiful restaurant where the rent is about a third of what Jonah pays. And he's been a huge success, but more on those pacing terms that you and Luke are talking about.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's this point where Jonah says, you know, if we don't get that review, I'll just be a neighborhood restaurant, which I understand. But the idea that aspiring to just have a neighborhood restaurant that would have some longevity and would service the community is a negative thing or something not to be wished for.
Or even more than a negative thing, it's not a survival strategy. I mean, Angeli was a monument in that neighborhood. People made special trips to go eat at Angeli.
Yeah, my restaurant.
Oh, sorry. Yes, Evan's restaurant. But the economics of it now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I closed in 2012 because I saw the writing on the wall. I saw right. that my model couldn't possibly survive.
But I think that's sad because Jonah is on some level your descendant. He is that guy who could have had a perfectly marvelous neighborhood restaurant, and it pained me sometimes to watch how hard it is for him. And not just for him, how hard it is for everybody on that block. You know, I used to stand in the kitchen, and I would walk home sometimes late at night, and every block is jam-packed with restaurants. And I'd walk by the ones that weren't so crowded, you know, and then I'd walk by David Chang's where people were lined up in the street. And during the time I was there, a couple of the places on that street closed. There was nothing wrong with them. It's just that one small local restaurant can't quite pay all the bills.
Well, not if you have staff. It has to be like the owners working it.
Right.
Can you speak to what you must have seen from both sides? His incredible frustration with being able to put together a kitchen staff and the people who are populating that kitchen also in their own minds having that not wanting to sit for more than a year mentality.
Jonah said after the fact, you know, we were at Barnes & Noble or something, and someone in the crowd asked him, what was the hardest part of having your own restaurant, given that you dreamed it for so long? And without hesitation, he said, the hardest thing was managing a staff. I never thought about how much energy was going to be required to sort of keep that family intact. He had a young guy come in, a 20-year-old guy who was going to a local community college, and had all the basic skills, and Jonah hired him over someone with more experience because he thought, I can mentor him the way David Waltuck mentored me. And in fact, he did, and he brought the guy up, and within a year's time, he went from being fry cook to line cook, and then there was a spot for sous chef opening up, and he was a little bit green for it, but Jonah basically sat him down and said, I'm going to do this for you. You're going to work really hard. It's going to make a huge difference in your life, but you have to commit. And it's going to be better for you than if you do the 1 year and out and go to some new restaurant and start over because there's a lot you still need to learn. And to Alberto's credit, he agreed, and he's still there. He's the sous chef, so he now knows how to run a kitchen when Jonah's not around. So you have to entice them in some other way. You have to make that restaurant family seem like something they want to be a part of.
Jonah's internal mantra was to view Huertas as his first restaurant, which of course implies that there would be others, and this was only the beginning. And he had in his mind sort of a roadmap of dates. So where is he with his endeavors?
Well, it's funny. He's 29 now. And in the last year, there have been a lot of, I don't want to say false starts, because they didn't even get that far. There's been a lot of what if. What if we did this? Do I have a bar and sell hot dogs and vermouth? Do I have a bar and sell cocktails and sandwiches? And then where he got to, right when he turned 29, was to take a breath and look around. And he thinks about all the other people who are in the book, okay? When Gavin Kaysen was 29, he was still a sous chef for Daniel Ballou. When Stephanie Izzard, who won Top Chef, was 29, she was in the emergency room because the first restaurant she owned was had put her out of commission. She was working so hard. So for the first time, I think, in his life, he took a breath and said, huh, maybe it's enough to know that there is going to be a next thing, and maybe I should take a minute and think about what that next thing should be and not be in such a rush because in the grand scheme of things, I'm not in such bad shape.
Journalist Karen Stabiner's new book is Generation Chef, Risking It All for a New American Dream. Next, let's find out what Laura Avery's shopping for at the farmer's market. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Now it's time for the market report. I understand we're going to be learning about leaks this week.
This is Laura Avery with the market report. Mark Peel in the house. Mark Peel is back at the Wednesday market. What are you shopping for?
Leeks. They're in season right now. It's the cool weather and they're at their best. So they're really firm, really sweet. You know, when it is really hot weather, they grow too fast and get pithy and tough. Mm-hmm. But right now they're really delicious.
So just briefly, what is a leek?
A leek is an onion. It's one of the many onions and it looks like a giant scallion or a green onion, mm-hmm. but it has more density, has more complexity of flavor. It's not quite as sharp as a green onion and it's great in things. You don't eat them raw.
Now, the trick to the leek is it's a very big, big, big stalk. And mm-hmm. isn't the goal to get more white than green? And how does that happen?
The white part towards the root is probably considered to be more valuable. But when I do things with leeks, I always put some of the green in because when it cooks, it has this beautiful emerald color. Mm-hmm. For instance, when I make a leek tart, which I have a recipe for and I'll give to you.
Ooh, good.
It's basically like a quiche and you take the leek and you slice it really thin across the grain so that it falls apart and then stew it really slowly with a lot of butter and then a little bit of garlic, a little bit of sage, a little bit of thyme. I'm gonna try today, I'm gonna find some sorrel that I'm gonna slice it really, really thin and put it in there and stew it in and then you reduce it with some cream. And you make a quiche, and it's sweet, delicious, complex, easy to do. It's a great party food because you can make it ahead of time.
And how much of the green do you incorporate?
I would say up to about 20% of the total.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to throw anything away. The green part is great in broths and, you know, chicken broths and veal stocks and so on and so forth, which very, very few people make at home, let's be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are making a broth, it's a great enhancer.
So you're getting leeks now for your tart. So you're going to braise them in butter
right. And
then add cream. It all sounds really good. Yeah.
You add cream. Mm-hmm. You cook that down. You set it aside, let it cool. And then I make a mixture of sour cream or creme fraiche with some egg yolks to make like a custard. Season that up just a little bit. And that becomes a layer on the bottom of a pre-baked pastry crust. I like to use puff pastry. That goes in the bottom. Then the leeks on top. And then just some simple breadcrumbs and with a little bit of butter. On top of that, my wife is the president of our neighborhood association, the Longwood Neighborhood Association. And when we have the annual gathering, it has doubled in size since I started serving this. I don't know why.
Let me guess.
Why
is it leeks aren't used more often?
I think leeks are not used more often because we're just not used to it. In France, leeks are very, very common. It's almost as common as a regular old brown onion. Here, people don't know quite what to do with them. You know what else is really interesting, really good, is if you slice them up, just as I said before, and then you get a skillet with some nice hot olive oil, not smoking hot, but nice and hot, and you put in small amounts of leek and you cook them really fast and caramelize them, and then take them out and set them aside and let them cool to room temperature. They'll crisp up a little bit, and it's great as a garnish on a salad.
They probably caramelize a lot like an onion. They're probably very high in sugar.
Yes.
Yeah. So, Mark, your new place down at Grand Central Market is called?
Bombo.
Bombo.
Yeah, we have very small steam jacketed kettles, and we're doing it that way because they're really fast, really clean, really efficient. It's really healthy,
mm-hmm.
and it focuses on seafood because they don't get super, super hot, but they carry a lot of heat. So they bring broth to a boil in about 45 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to bring things to people. So using these and making our own broths, we're able to have a price that is maybe 20% of what we have to charge at Campanile with mm-hmm. a huge staff and a huge building and everything. And
mm-hmm.
the flavors, the intensity of flavors and the quality of the ingredients are the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we pare away everything from a restaurant that doesn't have to do with food.
All right, Mark. Well, so good to see you back here. Do come out more often, please.
I will.
Yeah, come visit.
I will.
Yeah.
God, it feels like home.
That was Mark Peel. He's now the chef owner of Bombo downtown in Grand Central Market. And of course, he's probably best known for his long tenure at Campanile. And Mark is a fixture and a longtime friend of the farmers market. It's just great to see him back. We're talking now with Barbara Wyman, who works with Tutti Frutti Farm up in Lompoc. You've got quite the mound of leeks over here today. Tell us how they grow and why are they always so sandy?
Because they do grow down in the soil. As you can see, where the white part goes all the way up, that is all down in the ground in sandy soil. And then you see all those little roots just, you know, They just soak up all the dirt there. Most of the sand is in the root area, but because it's layered, you know, like an artichoke, the sand can get in there, but, you know, only goes so far down. You take a few outside leaves off and you're good.
So the part of the leek that's white is actually completely underground?
Yes, that's why that's white, and then the green part is with the, it gets the chlorophyll from the sun.
Now, yours look like they're trimmed. How much of that green stuff did you actually cut off the top?
I'd say it's more than several inches, because when they pull them out of the ground, you can see how short and stocky they are. Mm-hmm. But you figure, you know, they come to a point. They come pretty tall up to a point. So there's got to be several inches. I mean, we wouldn't be able to get them in the boxes.
I mean, those are all 2 feet long and longer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I noticed that they have the roots on them, and then garlic will have roots on. Mm. Is that a good thing to leave on?
Well, if you take too much of it off, it's just like cutting the roots off from any vegetable. You take too much of it off, it leaves it open. That, you know, the juice, the juice, like with any root vegetable, will start running out. You can see they cut a bit of the root off, because the root is a lot longer than that. They cut just enough root off without cutting into the flesh,
right,
and then losing the moisture and the juice from the root vegetable.
And they seem like they're really popular. Do you sell a lot of those?
Restaurants buy a lot, too. Yeah, it's a big thing with restaurants and customers. Yeah, we do sell a lot.
Mm-hmm. How do you cook your leeks?
I am allergic to onions. I don't eat any onion varieties.
Oh, that's so sad, because they're so tasty.
I don't even like the smell. I'm that allergic.
Okay. All right, Barbara, you've been coming down here with Tutti Frutti. You're sort of like the driving force behind this whole thing at the market. How long have you been working for Chris?
Over 30 years. When I got into this, I was a school bus driver. And you know Pam Boyer?
Yeah.
I met Pam Boyer when she was selling produce on up from where I lived. And she was then getting into the business of selling to Spago's and some of the other restaurants down here. And because I had a license as a truck driver, she hired me to do the truck driving. And at the same time, I started working for the farmers we were shipping for at the market. Anyway, so I was selling for him, and then I just started selling for other farmers and hooked up with Chris, and, you know, he's the one I stayed with.
30 years.
Yes.
Yes. All right, Barbara, well, in addition to the leeks, you've got so many other gorgeous root vegetables. You're even growing peppers in hoop houses right now, all certified organic. It's always a pleasure
and
to see your
boat. And we have our new spring asparagus, which is very popular, as you can see. That's where most of the crowd's at.
Now, the spring asparagus, you have that loose in a pile, and people can select their own stems.
Yep.
How much a pound?
They're 8 a pound.
Okay. Yeah, delicious. Everything from the really big jumbos all the way down to the little pencil-sized ones.
They can choose the ones they want.
Great. That's Barbara Wyman. She literally is the face of the Tutti Frutti Farm here at the Wednesday Market, and she and her team have just been doing such a great job selling this delicious organic produce all year round. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Find a recipe for Mark Peel's leek tart with creme fraiche on our blog. Go to blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. That is it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can always listen to the show at kcrw.com or on KCRW's mobile app or any of the other apps you use to do your podcasts. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. They are
Abby Fentress Swanson,
Laryl Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby.
Here's mine.
Camellia Say.
Joel Stein.
And Ronnie Mickelson.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more good food.